Okay, good evening. Welcome to the final session of this series. And as I said, we're going to aim to wrap up by around 8:30 or so with the in-depth look at the sources, so we can have a good 30 minutes at the end of some kind of practical follow-up reflection from a lot of what we've seen and put together some of the different pieces that came together. A few of you sent, actually did send emails with questions, which I appreciate, and we'll get to touch on some of those things, some at greater length, some at lesser length, and we'll take it from there. So this session is called Now, and it's because I really want to focus on what I think are the two main factors that are new to my mind, as it were, or more significantly dominant in our culture than perhaps they have been in the past, in terms of thinking through questions of kashrut. And we're in a way, you know, we spent the last two sessions thinking a lot about the social interactive piece of food and eating. And now, in a way, tonight's conversation is mostly going back to what we talked about the first 3 weeks, which is really the question of the food itself, independent of its context, and the pots and pans themselves that are used to prepare it. In particular, the two issues that I want to look at are soap and the materials revolution. Okay? These sound like very mundane, in some ways small issues, but I actually think that honestly, these factors are a lot of what make people think that kashrut is about magic as opposed to about some actual real engagement with food and how it affects things and how it gets affected by things. We have a lot of rules and a lot of approaches that we apply from a pre-soap, pre-materials revolution world to the world in which we live in. And while I hope to make the case for some of why that still might make sense, a lot of the confusion that people often feel around issues of kashrut, I think, cannot be separated from these two topics. So that's what we're going to look at in terms of the substance, but I hope you will take it as kind of a window into what it looks like to think about real-time application of a lot of the principles that we've seen. Okay? I have on the top of the sheet here on page one a reminder of a basic source that we saw early on, which was the debate between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Shimon over the question of noten ta'am lifgam. The idea there of a combination of foods where the forbidden food might in fact be contributing flavor to the mixture, but that flavor is damaging, is negative, is not something you would ever plan to do, and doesn't have any positive effect whatsoever. The question then being, well, what trumps? The fact that it contributed flavor and therefore it's forbidden, I can taste and sense the presence of the isur, of the prohibition, or the kind of quality of the experience and that being sufficiently negative to ignore it. And that was a debate between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Meir still forbidding and Rabbi Shimon permitting. And we talked about briefly how over time Rabbi Shimon's position comes to dominate and becomes a standard accepted principle of the halachic conversation. Question now is, can one take that sort of a further level and talk about certain substances that are not just a bad combination with a given type of food, but are a bad combination with any type of food? They fundamentally damage the flavor of all food that they come in contact with. They neutralize that flavor in some way. Does Rabbi Shimon's principle of noten ta'am lifgam apply to that as well? Specifically, soap is a very good example of this, where when I put my dishes into my sink and I pour dish soap all over them, does that render everything that is then in that sink essentially a non-entity in terms of its halachic status of food? Okay? And you could ask that from any number of angles. You could ask, what if there's a piece of treif meat that happens to? What if there is some milk that happens to, and then it's a question of its being mixed with meat? What if I take a pot that's treif, and it then gets submerged in soapy water, or it's run through a dishwasher? Has that pot now been koshered, and it's completely irrelevant what its history was? Why, if so? Why not, if not? Right, those are the questions. Now we're going to look at some of the main approaches to this as they've played out. The Shulchan Aruch has a ruling under Roman numeral 1 here, one of the few and unusual rulings in the Shulchan Aruch that is essentially the offering of a personal opinion without any basis in any prior source. It's very uncommon, right? Most of the time you go back to the Beit Yosef and you find Rav Yosef Karo's, you know, preparatory work for coming to his psak. This simply falls out of the sky. It seems to me, okay, Yera'eli, that if this is in the context of talking about washing meat and dairy dishes, okay, and the whole section of the Shulchan Aruch up until this point has been, what if I have a basin of hot water, really hot water, that is hot enough to be a concern of transferring flavor, and I accidentally put both my meat and dairy dishes with all the stuff on them into that basin. And all kinds of conversations about how you deal with it, what you have to throw out, what you don't have to throw out. He then adds, it seems to me that if there were ashes put in the hot water, and the ashes here means soap, okay, we're talking about basically some kind of material that has been put in that is made with a base, soap was sometimes made with a base of ash, that you would put this in the hot water. If you put that in the hot water in the dairy cauldron before the meat dishes went into it, then everything remains permitted, even if there's fat stuck on the dishes, because al yedei ha'efer hu noten ta'am lifgam. The ashes, the soap here, render any flavor damaging. So you have a situation where normally you have a hot thing of water, you're putting meat and milk residue in the same thing, that creates a mixture of meat and milk, the pots and dishes are in it then, they absorb that, become affected by it. If they're not the kind of thing that can be koshered, like they're made of earthenware, you'll have to smash them. But if before the opposite kind of food went in, you put some kind of soap in there, says the Shulchan Aruch, that completely neutralizes what was in there before, and now everything remains permitted. Nothing has been affected, all the food is neutralized. Okay? So, that's a pretty direct statement of the potential power of soap. The question is, how far does one take that on two levels? One, is the Shulchan Aruch's ruling accepted? Or will there be resistance to it? And even to the extent it is accepted, what is the scope? Right, what's the scope of this permission? And again, there's at least three different levels. One is that soap itself could basically neutralize the entire history of a pot that it comes in contact with. Lesser, on a lesser radical plane, the soap might neutralize anything it comes in contact with but doesn't erase the history of the pot. That is to say, it's not as if a soap, a fleshic pot being, you know, soaked in soapy water is now a power of pot, but that anything that's on any pot, including tray food, becomes neutralized. Even things that are themselves forbidden can become neutralized by soap. Or the most moderate reading of the Shulchan Aruch would be this is only kind of prior to a mixing of milk and meat where the item itself, nothing was actually forbidden and the soap enters into the equation before there's any prohibition whatsoever. Okay? We'll run through that now and see that. But I want to just offer you a couple of kind of guiding comments for thinking through why people might take different positions here. And there's at least three different factors I think we should be thinking about. One, which doesn't have anything to do with soap or kashrut per se, is you do find along the way in various halachic debates that there will be resistance to something that is perceived as technologically new. Right? The idea of, but we never had this option before, no one ever talked about this before, there was never a magical substance out there that we used that neutralized all of our food, and therefore almost for that reason alone, it is forbidden and problematic, and we can't rely on this kind of reasoning. Now, you see this in any number of areas. Hilchot Shabbat, the Nodav Yudah, has a famous lengthy tshuva on an umbrella on Shabbat. And the entire ethos of that tshuva is one where he is clearly like afraid of the umbrella. Okay? By which I mean there's a sort of resistance of, no one ever had umbrellas before, and suddenly, you know, some designer of an umbrella decides to invent this object. Everyone decides they have to have it. And now we're going to sort of have this be one of the things we carry around on Shabbat. Unacceptable. It must be boneh. It must be an act of building something, etc. But you get a sense that prior to even knowing what's wrong with it, there's something wrong with it. Okay? So that's one thing to think about when you think about soap. And the history of soap is that, you know, it does exist prior to the Shulchan Aruch, but it is in the time of the Shulchan Aruch and onwards that it comes to be something that is much more frequently used and sort of mass-produced by more and more people. We take for granted that everyone has their little soap dispenser next to every internal plumbing device in our house. That was certainly not true for most people living in the Middle Ages. And this is part of that's why that newness of it is one question. The second question is, Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Shimon have this debate. And yeah, Rabbi Shimon formally wins that debate. But that doesn't mean that Rabbi Meir totally disappears. By which I mean Rabbi Meir's position, which seems to feel that, you know, it may be a damaging presence, but you can't sort of totally erase what the thing is. If the thing is forbidden and it's there, there's something problematic about that. A number of the positions that we'll see that resist this seem, in fact, to think like Rabbi Meir, even if they talk like Rabbi Shimon. Even if they agree that notein tam lifgam is a permitted category fundamentally, maybe resistant to say, I have a piece of ham here, and now I simply spray some palm olive on top of it, and it's parv. Okay? And maybe some of you feel that way as well. And this, of course, I don't mean that you can eat it, okay? But that its capacity to sort of affect anything else has been completely neutralized. Meaning, okay, a sort of simple example of this is the OUs that you see on dish soaps. I mean, what's that about? Right, this is one of my college friends. He remembers he was living with had a non-Jewish friend who lived down the hall from him, who really had no background in religion whatsoever, and he, you know, had a very nice relationship, and he began explaining to him, you know, all sorts of things, and explaining, you know, food and food practices, and he said, yeah, actually, you know, there's a lot of food that's marked as kosher, you don't often see it, but, you know, he showed him, here's this OU, you know, on this, etc. A week later, the guy comes bursting into the dorm room with a box of Tide and says, you people eat detergent? Right? So this is noten tam lifgam asur on some level. The fear is there could be things, I mean, yeah, Tide takes it to a slightly higher level, but dish soap, right, it's there with your dishes, it's there with everything. If you don't assume that the presence of chemicals completely renders irrelevant the potential non-kosher elements that might be in a soap, whether it's animal tallow or other things, then you would potentially need a hechsher. But that would hinge on what you think the power of soap is to forbid and to neutralize. But the third, which is in some ways I think the most important and calls you back to what we did in week three about the development of the Talmudic sugya around the question of pots. You'll recall my argument to you was the original Tosefta text about the pots had nothing to do with flavor whatsoever and ta'am. It had to do with a purging ritual of reversing its character from what it was. And that was the key element. And then, in the context of the Gemara, the notion of netinat ta'am, of flavor and purging of flavor, gets introduced by the Gemara as a kind of add-on layer to that Tosefta. That development leaves a very interesting and problematic legacy for the conversation around soap. Why? If you think that the entire ritual of purging is, following the Gemara, all about the erasure of flavor, then you may view with suspicion someone who says, but wait a minute, you know, they'll say soap can neutralize all of the flavor even in a pot. You may then say to that person, but wait a minute, if that were true, couldn't you just kosher a pot by soaking it in soapy water? And the Gemara clearly doesn't allow for that because it prescribes this very specific purging ritual. Therefore, it must be that the Talmud does not hold that an agent like soap can completely neutralize flavor. Now, of course, the response is, no, you might say that soap completely neutralizes the flavor, maybe even in a pot, but the purging ritual, the koshering, is still important because it actually predates the whole idea of ta'am being the issue. It actually has a separate quality and character to it of reversing the character of the pot, the utensil, and therefore one doesn't imply the other. But some of the debates will end up focusing around whether once the Gemara has blurred the purging ritual with the expulsion of flavor, then perhaps, you know, you actually have to take more seriously that maybe the Talmud's way of getting rid of flavor is the only way, as it were. Okay, so that's just to flag those things. Now as we jump into the actual engagement with this and see how it plays out. Okay, so let's see a little bit of the back and forth here, what I've called the attacks and defenses of the Shulchan Aruch, and then some different strategies for interpreting. We won't read all of these, but we'll go through a bunch. Okay, so someone, please read me the Taz on page 1. One initial response to the Shulchan Aruch. Go ahead.
Based on this, there is no prohibition if soap made of forbidden fat fell into cooked food, since the soap has ash added when made from forbidden fat. But this ruling requires investigation. I found in the name of the Maharil that once a child came and reported that a piece of soap made from forbidden fat fell into a pot, and Maharil said not to believe the child. This implies that if we had known for sure that the soap had fallen in, it would have forbidden the food. But the claim here is that the soap made from forbidden fat and ash contributes a damaging flavor. This ruling, therefore, requires further investigation before one can act on it.
Yeah, that question mark's better a exclamation point. Okay? The Shulchan Aruch's ruling, says the Taz, would imply that soap is a neutralizing agent. But there is this ruling of the Maharil hundreds of years earlier dealing with borit, some other kind of cleaning agent that's made out of animal fat and some kind of ash, and does not assume that that is a neutral item. Right? Is engaging with whether we have to trust the kid that this thing actually fell into the food, therefore forbade it, etc., etc. And therefore, you can't rely on this position of the Shulchan Aruch. Okay, read the Nekudat HaKesef's response, the next source here.
There's no difficulty here at all. The Shulchan Aruch was only ruling that the ash renders the film of fat on the dishes to be damaging, but was not commenting on a case like Maharil's, where there is a block of forbidden fat.
All right, so here we have an attempt to sort of pull back the Shulchan Aruch's ruling in an effort to defend the Taz. To defend the Shulchan Aruch, to attack the Taz. The Taz said, this principle is wrong. The idea that soap neutralizes is not accepted among earlier authorities. To which the Shach and the Nekudot HaKesef says, well, maybe the Shulchan Aruch is making a more limited claim than you think. Not that soap can actually neutralize an entire block of lard. But when you're talking about some sort of low-level film on a pot, that kind of level of mamashut isur, that level of actual substance, can be neutralized, and therefore you could still defend the Shulchan Aruch's basic ruling here. But we'll see the Shach himself take aim on it in a moment. Yeah.
To be clear, also the Taz specifically is talking about soap that itself is made of forbidden items, and that's why it's in danger of the Maharil of forbidding it. It's not that it can neutralize a block of lard, it's that it is a block of lard.
Yes, but it's a block of lard with ash and rendered not to be food anymore, but to be some kind of cleaning agent. The same way you might make a soap out of, right, animal fat, and many, many companies did until not very long ago. And some still do. The idea here is, though, that perhaps there's some difference of when the whole thing is sort of its own block as opposed to when it's being mixed in with other things. All right, but you see here, the Taz is resisting, right? This idea that to some of you may seem very obvious of course soap neutralizes everything it comes in contact with, is being resisted here. All right, and again, I gave you those different factors of why it is you might see that resistance. Nekudat HaKesef pushing back. Rav Ovadia Yosef here, just in a tshuva, quotes the Tzemach Tzedek, which is the easiest way for me to pull it up. Rav Menachem Mendel Krochmal from the 17th century, so contemporary, more or less, of the Shach and the Taz, and who also defends the Shulchan Aruch against the Taz. Do not depart from the ruling of the Beit Yosef, who permits based on the logic of damaging flavor. He is the later authority. He has illuminated our eyes with his rulings, which are spread out to the entire diaspora, and we follow him. Okay? So that's one back and forth on the Shulchan Aruch. You see one angle of controversy. All right, let's see the Shach versus the Chacham Tzvi. You'll get one other angle on this, and then we'll go to a different interpretive strategy. Yeah?
So, just the Shulchan Aruch would say that the whole idea of separate sinks, separate dishes, now that we have soap, is ridiculous.
More or less. But that depends how you're going to read the Shulchan Aruch. But yes, even the most minimal reading of the Shulchan Aruch, which we'll get to in a minute, that's to say in a kosher home, where the only thing that's the concern is basically the mixing of milk and meat, right? That's the only thing that can go wrong. More or less that's the case. The one caveat to that is how much one reads the Shulchan Aruch as lechatchila authorizing the use of soap to have this effect, and how much he is simply confirming that b'diavad, if the facts play it out this way, it's a reason to be lenient. Okay? Even that can sort of be subdivided between, am I using the soap in order to actively neutralize the food and avoid a kashrut problem? Or I'm using the soap in order to do something perfectly innocuous, which is to wash the dishes, and as a result, it has this effect. And you might permit someone to do that lechatchila, right? Even if you would say, you can't go around neutralizing isurim in order to get around prohibitions, but you are allowed to wash dishes, and that you're allowed to plan to do. And if it turns out that the regime you use for washing dishes means meat and milk will never come in contact, then yes. And that is practice in any number of observant homes that follow the Shulchan Aruch, is one sponge. Yeah.
According to the Shulchan Aruch, the order would make a difference. In other words, if you put milk and meat dishes in your water and then added the soap, it's too late.
That is correct. Well, maybe. We don't yet know what the Shulchan Aruch, and we actually can't know what the scope of the Shulchan Aruch is, and that's why I sort of laid that out at the beginning before even getting to the back and forth. We know that the Shulchan Aruch thinks that soap has the power to neutralize. What exactly, we don't yet know. The Taz seems to assume that the Shulchan Aruch is advocating neutralization of even things that are totally treif, and that's why the Maharil contradicts him. And the Shach seems to assume that as well. He's just saying maybe there's different subcategories of that. Okay? We'll see another. Read us the Shach for the next line here. The Shach and followed by the Chacham Tzvi as a pair.
This rule cannot be found in any earlier authority, and none of the Rishonim mentioned it. Rabbi Yosef Karo did not even mention it in the Beit Yosef. On the contrary, it seems implied in the words of earlier decisors that there is no way to permit via boiling a recently used pot unless there is a 60-to-1 ratio of water to the volume of the pot.
Okay, whether this is technology, that's the right way to talk about it. It's that same basic thing of, we never used this before. You can't suddenly, this is the new way that you're going to permit koshering, right? Because according to this, what's his point? You no longer need to submerge anything, according to the Shach, in 60 times the volume and to worry about those issues, okay, when it's, you know, a freshly used pot. As long as you throw some soap in there, you're done. Right? Big deal. It'll absorb the flavor and everything will be neutralized. So again, the Shach seems to assume that the Shulchan Aruch's position is a hardcore position of soap neutralizing. And therefore, unacceptable, you can't rely on this. Okay? Even though he defended him before, he wasn't an Amma Aretz. He knew the Maharil. He's making a different case than the Taz claims. Nonetheless, on the actual matter of the law, he rejects it. All right, so now let's hear the counterattack defense.
That which the Shach wrote, that this rule is not found in any earlier authority, is meaningless, and he should not have written it. It is clear from the Gemara and all decisors that damaging flavor is permitted, and even if it is only damaging in a minor way, all the more so in the case of ashes and water, which is seriously damaging and as is detectable by anyone. Must authorities pedantically enumerate all the possible ways that food can have its flavor damaged? The ear hears words and the palate tastes food. One should rule like the Shulchan Aruch that utensils rinsed in ashes and water are permitted on account of the damaging flavor, and soap does not forbid at all. And even though Maharil indicates to the contrary, we don't follow him, since common sense contradicts him, and I suspect that there was another motive at work in his case.
All right, so that's a great passage on the Chacham Tzvi. And the exchange of the Chacham Tzvi with the Shach, I think, is actually a great window into the tension sometime between whether one lives by practices or by principles. Right? The Shach is really sort of saying, there's a certain way that Jews deal with whether pots have gotten screwed up or not. And soap was never one of the factors there. And because of some Yera Eli and the Shulchan Aruch, we're not upending that whole thing. And the Chacham Tzvi, by contrast, is saying, no, what Jews have done is followed the principle of notin tam lifgam mutar. In situations where there wasn't soap, that translated into this kind of regime of practice. Now that there is soap, it translates into this. And it's an interesting way in which both of them are, you know, both stabilizing and destabilizing at the same time. Ostensibly, the shach is stabilizing in terms of the picture in the kitchen looks the same as it did before soap is becoming a more major player on the scene. But what is being destabilized in the shach is the live kind of common sense anchor of noten ta'am lifgam as meaning something. Right? Is there a meaning to saying damaging flavor is not forbidden? And if there is, soap should make a difference. The Chacham Tzvi has the opposite considerations at play. And that, I think, is a good dynamic that you see in a number of places, but very, very prominent here. Anything on that exchange? Before now, we're going to go to a different read of the Shulchan Aruch. This is the read of the Shulchan Aruch of, you see some voices trying to say, well, have none of this. Okay, soap is not going to be a part of the picture. It does not have the power to neutralize for various reasons that we've seen here.
I just have a question, a point of clarification. Are you just talking about the pot itself, vis-a-vis the soap? Or are you talking about the soap insofar as there might be something that's not kosher, that's an item, in which that item can be neutralized?
Right. So we're gonna.
And how does that item itself be impacted? Or are they subtly or meaningfully two different things?
Great.
I'm going towards gelatin and things like that.
They're definitely potentially two different things. In this first section, what I wanted you to see is the folks who say it doesn't do anything. Okay, we see there's people pushing back on them and defending the Shulchan Aruch's honor. But really, in some ways, what you see in that first category is consciousness of the possibility that soap might neutralize everything. And the Shach and the Taz and a few others saying it neutralizes nothing. Right? Now we're going to see three other sort of positions, or two other positions, basically, that will fill out exactly the picture that you're asking about. Okay, so let's read the Yavetz also. Okay, the Chacham Tzvi's son follows up, kind of defending his father's logic, just so you see the defense of the Shulchan Aruch and playing it out in practice. Here we have an interesting question about beans that are rinsed in a soap that contains some kind of forbidden animal product in it, in order basically to polish them, okay? Basically to give them a shine. And is it permissible to buy them? All right. And if you hold that soap has no power to neutralize, what's basically happened here is your beans were just given a thorough trafe rinse. Right? How can you eat that? And the only way you could is by arguing they're having been neutralized. So let's just hear what he says about this on the top of three. Someone want to take the Yavetz, or Yaakov Emden. Please.
You reported that the rabbinic authority in question instructed people not to eat wet beans purchased from the Gentiles because he heard that the beans are rinsed in a cleaning agent called soap in order to shine them. This is very surprising to me. What could possibly be wrong? The soap is not intended to impart fragrance or flavor. Moreover, in the present case, any flavor would not be pleasing, but rather damaging, in accordance with our holding that soap contributes to negative flavor. Given that it has ash mixed in and it is only intended to improve the appearance of the beans so that they will look white and shiny. Therefore, this is an excessive, baseless stringency. Even if we knew for sure that the soap was used in this way, and all the more so, that it is only a possibility. Perhaps this authority holds that ash does not contribute an unpleasing flavor against the Beit Yosef, given that the Shach attacks him. But if so, he is also wrong, because the Shach himself was roundly criticized, as wrote my father and others, and they are correct. Moreover, even one who is stringent has no basis for stringency here. Where even if such an agent is used, it is clearly used in small amounts and only used to remove dirt and not as an ingredient.
Okay, so even from the language here of Mechabsin oto biborit shekorin zayif, right, that this cleaning agent called soap, you sort of get a sense of this becoming an increasing player on the scene. There is some kind of borit that is a cleaning agent that comes before, so there's an analog to it, and that's what the Maharil had talked about. But the soap that seems to be the afer-based issue that the Shulchan Aruch is beginning to talk about and is becoming more and more of an issue in 17th and 18th century sources is beginning to take over. And you see here, it is not a done deal how this argument is coming out, and you have these voices that are just afraid, essentially, but there's a presence of some Isur there. It's a sort of very almost intuitive feeling of, some pig touched my food. I don't want to eat it. And that's the sort of, that's the Rabbi Meir worldview in a way, in tension with what it would mean to take Notan Tam Livgam seriously and to say, that's been completely neutralized in terms of the character of this object. Okay? Yeah.
We add something very unique here. The soap is not intended to impart fragrance or flavor.
Correct.
That's a profound, way beyond anything you've ever heard, that it's the intent that has some effect on whether or not it creates this situation or something would not be permitted.
Right. Well, the presumption is also, I think, that and it doesn't really contribute flavor, in part because it's used for just appearance. But this notion of the category of chazuta, right, does play out in a number of other sources, whether chazuta itself is a problem. A place where this will come up, for instance, is what if something is under the 1/60th threshold, but it is a powerful enough dye that it nonetheless leaves an impression, right? That will sort of come out to where I have to consider the presence of something with chazuta in that regard. But you're right that here he's sort of deploying the difference between that category and tam as also another factor. It's very clear. I mean, it's a tendentious tshuva in the sense that he is clearly hell-bent on, one, defending his father's position and honor, and two, saying it must be permitted to buy these beans. But in the course of it, is also sort of defending, come on, notin tam is supposed to make sense. Right? This is supposed to be a category that makes sense, and that would demand us being lean. So, yeah?
I'm having trouble bridging the gap between what seems like two issues, not distinct, but two different issues. One is the question of the soap itself, and the other one is the question of the effect of the soap on the dishes. It seems like the Chacham Tzvi and Yaakov Emden are dealing with here is the question of whether the soap, since it's made from something treif, is still okay to use because it has all this gross ash in it. And the effect of the soap is thus neutralized. Whereas the second question is whether soap can be used because of its grossness that's inherent in it in terms of taste, making food taste weird and soapy, that whether that would actually help reset dishes.
Dishes as opposed to the food itself, you mean?
Right.
Yeah, that's what we're going to get to presently. All right, we're going to get to that in a second, and that'll be clear, right? So far, all we've seen here in Section A is the potential very broad power of soap to neutralize, and a number of voices that lined up against it very strongly, among them the Shach and the Taz, and some efforts to repel them, all right? But on some level, we haven't gotten any finer grain definition of where this applies. There seems to be a fear that this is an overarching principle that might take over the whole conversation of Tom, and both resistance to and defense, at least, of the principle. But how far the defense goes, that's where we now have to see some different approaches. It is certainly plausible that the defense of some of these positions goes all the way, imagines that it neutralizes anything, including the pots, etc., but it may stop short of that. It's hard to know. Because these are defensive arguments, all we know is that they reject what they're arguing against, but it's hard to know exactly how they read the Shulchan Aruch. Okay? Great. So let's move on to letter B here on page 3. Okay? And here you'll see in the Pitchei Tshuva a more modest reading of the Shulchan Aruch, that perhaps what can be a sort of compromise view, where we don't really think that the Shulchan Aruch's view does all that much, but we don't actually reject it in quite the way the Shach and the Taz does. Okay, so someone want to take this one, Pitchei Tshuva. Yeah.
In response to my note about this at length and resolve of the problems of the Shach, I wrote that the Shulchan Aruch is not claiming here that ashes can render prohibitions unpleasing, but rather that in the specific case of meat and milk, the ashes can weaken the flavor of the meat, such that when it later combines with milk, it will no longer be considered a forbidden mixture. And this would also address the challenge brought by the Taz from Maharila.
All right, so one line of defense of the Shulchan Aruch against the Shach and the Taz is to say, wait a minute, what was the Shulchan Aruch talking about? Meat and milk. Was never talking about treif, was never talking about the history of pots, was making a very modest claim, which is, what do I need? To create a basar bechalav prohibition, I need meat to come in contact with milk. If before they come in contact, it's meat coming in contact with soapy milk, that's not basar bechalav. It's already been sort of weakened in its permitted state before it was able to create some prohibition. But the Shulchan Aruch too would for sure agree that if you were dealing with something that was already forbidden, like the Maharil's case of the tallow that's mixed into some kind of cleaning agent, of course the soap is not capable of neutralizing that, to say nothing of the history of the pots. Okay, so this is one way to give some space to the principle of Shulchan Aruch and the soap playing a role, but it's the most minor role you can give it. So the first view that we saw was rejecting the power of soap to neutralize altogether. Level two is represented in this Pitrei Tshuva of it neutralizes meat and milk on their own. Yeah?
Are you assuming that you're washing your dishes in boiling water? Because I feel like a lot of the issue would be about cooking, and if it wasn't boiling water, you might not have a cooking issue to begin with.
They're not assuming boiling, but they are assuming yad soledet bo, such that your hand would recoil, and that therefore it clears the threshold of the problem. That is to say, it's hot enough to cause a problem. And they're assuming, in general, like in the Shulchan Aruch's case, they're assuming a soaking in that water in order to loosen up all the particles on the plates. Yeah, exactly. Now, I'll remind you that Pitrei Tshuva is still highly significant in the context of a kosher kitchen. Okay? The Pitrei Tshuva clearly thinks that, like, if you threw all of your dishes into the sink and they were meat and milk and all strewn together and put soap all over the top of them, no matter what then happened, nothing could possibly be forbidden. Okay? And certainly that a sponge that has come into contact with soap always is always parv. Right? It would not necessarily say that this helps you at all with saying anything about a treif restaurant. Okay? But this minimal kind of articulation is still very significant in terms of its potential impact. Okay? Now let's go one level up from this. Alright? If so far we've got soap has no effect, and that's the Shach and the Taz. And now we have soap neutralizes meat and milk, which is the Pitrei Tshuva. Now we'll get to a further level, which is two other possibilities. Soap neutralizes forbidden items, and soap erases the history of utensils, renders them all parv, as it were. Okay? So, let's see that. We're now going to jump to 18th century Algiers on page 4. Okay? And hear what the Beit Yehuda has to say. Okay? Avi, you want to read this one?
Beit Yehuda. It happened once that a meat spoon was rinsed in hot water with soap. And then the spoon was submerged in a dairy dish within 24 hours in prior contact with the meat. I was asked about this, and I had to measure to see if there was 61 to nullify any flavor trapped in the spoon.
All right, this is like a standard kashrut question, right? It's within 24 hours. And he measures 60 to 1 because the spoon became fleishik, right, because of its contact with the meat. And then its contact with the dairy food, I have to make sure that there's 60 times the volume of the submerged part of the spoon in the food if I don't want the meat flavor from that spoon to contaminate this dairy dish. Okay? But then
60 of hot water versus
60, no. 60 of the... No, I don't think he's thinking about the hot water. He could have asked that potentially, but he could have asked that, but he's asking about the 60 of the, like, the pot of, you know, dairy soup or whatever it is. whether that is 60 to 1 against the spoon, which has become flesh.
He's measuring the like volume of utensils.
Correct.
Afterwards, I asked my teacher, of blessed memory, and he permitted, on account of the Shulchanah's ruling, Yardin and Fedor, that soap damages flavor. If so, then when the spoon was rinsed in hot water, it spat out whatever it had absorbed, and then reabsorbed the meat flavor, along with the damaging flavor of the soap, such that when it was then submerged in dairy food, it contributed a damaging flavor and did not prevent it.
All right, that's which category? No, four. Because this is erasing the history of the spoon. Let's remember the fact pattern here. It's a meat spoon before there's any rinsing or anything. That means this was a ladle that was used in a pot of chicken soup. Okay? It absorbs it. It's a fleshic item. And it was used in the last 24 hours. All that happened between that spoon going into, coming out of the meat pot and going into the dairy food was that it was rinsed in hot, soapy water. That's all that happened. Now, the only way that that makes any sense to permit based on that is if what you're saying is when any spoon, even if used in the last 24 hours, any utensil is submerged in hot, soapy water, it becomes parv in terms of its effect on anything else.
You're saying the crucial distinction here is that it was soapy, but then it was rinsed off.
That it was inside.
Not currently soapy.
Not what?
It's not currently soapy.
It's not currently soapy when it's put into the food. No. And it was not soapy when it was used with the meat initially.
This is just like you washed your fleshic spoon and then you used it in your soup.
This is you put, yeah. This is just to like give you the modern analog. This is the object was run through the dishwasher.
He doesn't say it's parv. Okay. He says it contributes damaging flavor, so he still thinks it's meat. Spoon. Just bringing in damaging flavor.
So let me clarify. This is what I mean. I don't mean to suggest it's parv. He doesn't think then you have to kosher. Okay? But that goes back to whether I still need to do the purging ritual. Let me clarify here. It doesn't erase it in that sense. Erases the history of utensils for the purpose of affecting other things. If you challenge the Beit Yehuda and said, how can you say that? The Torah says that the Talmud says you have to kosher pots, and there has to be some procedure. He would answer you, I think, whatever his language would be, he would answer like a good, critical student of Talmud and say, the Tosefta is an earlier version that doesn't have no din tam lifgam, meaning that ritual of needing to kosher something is a totally separate thing of starting over with an object that you used in a different way that's incompatible with how you're going to use it now. But that's completely separable from whether this pot has some kind of ongoing live ability to affect anything else. According to the Beit Yehuda, you run something through a dishwasher, it does not affect any food that was ever put on it. Period. End of story. Okay? Whether the Beit Yehuda allows you lechatchila, therefore, to just simply load up meat and dairy into a dishwasher with all the stuff in it at the same time without even worrying whether the soap releases before any water goes in, etc., is less clear, but it's very clear that if you did that, irrelevant. Okay? That is, there's no capacity for the plates to affect anything according to this view. This is the most extreme view. I don't want to say extreme, like it's crazy, but this is the most expansive view of what it means to embrace soap as a neutralizing agent. All you're left with is a sort of like ceremonial purging, some kind of ceremonial koshering you might have to do, at least when the object is yours, in order to move it from its prior state to this, but it has nothing to do with ta'am anymore. The soap completely removes it. Okay? Now, let's see the next text so you'll see another person articulate this and then a resistance to it. Okay, so someone want to take the Beit David? Takes a similar stance. Yeah.
Rav Yosef Kovo, 18th century chief rabbi of Salonika, said that the food absorbed in the pot also is damaged by soap, because the sudsy water is absorbed into the pot and damages the previously absorbed taste as well. Such pots become as if they had not been used for 24 hours. If someone cooked meat in a dairy utensil that had been soaked in this sudsy water, or vice versa, the resultant food would be permissible to eat b'diavad.
All right, that's straight up. That's that same view, and very clearly in terms of what the effect is. B'diavad, after the fact, there's no capacity. It does not matter. You cooked, if you ran your fleishik pot, you cooked a chicken soup in a pot, then you ran that pot through the dishwasher. And then the same night, after that cycle finishes, you make vichyssoise in that pot. It is permitted to eat the soup. Okay? Whether it's permitted to use the pot is not suggested here, and I don't think anyone would say that, because there would still be an attachment to the notion that, but you're still supposed to do this reversal ritual. It's still a fleishik pot in terms of how you designated it. You have to reverse that. But in terms of the food, and in terms of any situation that would be a bidiavad situation, which we talked about briefly in week 3, it would not present an issue. All right, continue. Now let's see what the Beit David says.
But I think that a damaging agent only damages what is outside, on the surface of the utensil. What is absorbed is not damaged. In practice, because the Shulchan Aruch's opinion of the soap contributes a bad taste is novel, we should understand his words narrowly. We should apply this ruling specifically in the case he mentioned, meaning the taste of food subsumed to the soap is damaged, but not that which is inside the utensil.
Now, interestingly enough, the Beit David assumes, in the fuller context here, the Beit David assumes that the Shulchan Aruch is not limited to milk and meat. He just assumes the Shulchan Aruch is not dealing with stuff inside the pots, but he actually doesn't limit it to the degree that the Pitchei Tshuva did of only limiting it to Category 2. Alright? So you see here basically four different potential positions for understanding how to process the power of soap. And I think you can kind of see the range of not just halachic articulation of response, but the range of what I think different people actually honestly feel about this topic when they think about it. I think there are people who think very much in terms of Category 1, which is to say, they really want that heksher on the dish soap in the kitchen, and they really want two separate sponges, and the notion of, like, these things are just not supposed to come in contact, and it doesn't matter what other intermediary things are involved. Milk and meat are supposed to stay separate. I don't care if there's soap in the middle. Treif stuff stays away, and I don't use it even if there's soap. And certainly pots totally retain their character independent of when they were run through the dishwasher. Just as equally, I don't know how it breaks down in terms of the population, but many people who very much think about the world in terms of Category 4, which is having a very hard time taking seriously that almost anything in a modern kitchen, and certainly a modern industrial kitchen that's been run through a hot dishwasher, has any character to it whatsoever. And the idea of having two separate sponges and worrying about things mixing in the dish in the sink simply seems alien to them in a world in which there are all kinds of cleaning agents that are constantly erasing the identity of all the other things hanging out there. And then, of course, positions that can reasonably be in the middle of those two. But I think to understand this, you actually want to be able to understand why you would have either of those two kind of goalposts on this, and the ways in which that potentially affects practice, which we'll integrate into our comments sort of towards the end. Okay? Anything else on the soap piece here? Because we're going to move to another angle. Yeah?
I still find it, like, kind of strange with the Beit Yehuda that in the end he talks about how the spoon at the end of the whole washing process is still not in Talmud Gam. I don't see I think he should be saying it has no Tam. Like, it's a race to history. You rinsed off the soap. Like, he's like, he's got this whole, like, additive thing where, like, it has the flavor of the meat and the flavor of the...
Well, you may be being led astray by my use of neutralizing. Which is to say, what he really is saying, I find that a helpful language for understanding kind of what the actual effect of it is. But what he's in fact saying is the soap combines with whatever was in there to create a package that is damaging flavor, such that then when it comes out and affects something else, it doesn't affect it because of the principle, no ten tam lifgam mutar. So it's not like he's saying on the chemical level, whether he ever thought there was on the chemical level something like that in the first place, but he's not like he's saying on the chemical level there's no meat there. He's saying, though, kind of halachically, normatively, we care about ta'am lishvach, some kind of positive contribution. And whenever soap enters into the picture, that's gone. Simply gone. Okay? Or another way of thinking about this is, when you take your wooden spoon out of the dishwasher, if you were to suck on it, it would not taste like meat. It would taste like a dishwasher. Right? It would taste like soap. Or it would even just taste like wood. But it would sort of have no residue whatsoever. The experience of running something through, and you know, with Sani rinse and all those other things that we put in, is that that's in fact exactly what those cleaning agents are supposed to do, is to make it completely irrelevant what was used there before, and you almost can't tell. Right? I mean, even just that basic thing of you take for granted that you go into, you know, you go into a restaurant and you use, you know, forks, knives, plates, etc., other things that look as if they've never been used before, basically, unless they were scratched, right? All of that, and particularly that level of cleanliness, is made possible because of cleaning with intensive cleaning agents with very hot water and the ways in which, yeah, it actually erases all residue of what was there before. Yes?
Just before we leave soap, is there a reason why, especially in the second and third page of the sources, there's this, like, extreme defensiveness and, like just the tone is so different than all the other sources we looked at? Like, you think that this kind of, like tearing down on each other would happen more with, like, Basar Bakala or something, like, more incendiary, but, like, why so?
So, I mean, these things happen in other areas, too, and just, I didn't necessarily, like, bring every incendiary source that there is, but I think the issues on the table here that drive it here are some of the ones that I flagged. I do think there is a kind of what I call the technological nervousness around something that can potentially have broad sweeping effect in redetermining all the categories that we work with, and a fear of that. I think there is some lingering attachment to Rabbi Meir, which is to say, even though we formally rule like Rabbi Shimon, the idea that really no ten tam leaf gum is the only real factor, I think even though people can't say that in formal legal language, they're nervous about it. And then the last piece is, I do think the way in which the Gemara wrapped up this question of ta'am with the question of the purging ritual of koshering creates sort of confusion and nervousness about destabilization of those categories. That's my best guess. It's speculation, ultimately, but that's my best guess.
Two points?
Yeah.
One, if you look at it as a construct, that the soap is tantamount to an item or a pot that wasn't used for longer than 24 hours, which one of the sources earlier introduced,
mm-hmm.
you know, then it makes it really very simple to look at it in that way, that the soap as a bad thing is similar to that non-use for 24 hours.
That's right.
And in that sense, the item that's then been put into it becomes permitted. But I don't think at any point, unless I heard you wrong, you're suggesting that pot, either because it's over 24 hours or that soap has been used on it, becomes transformed into something else. It's only that the item which was placed into it somehow, because of the soap, or that it's longer than 24 hours, becomes...
Correct. The same way we'll...
That's the no same time, by no same time, right?
We'll see. Well, it's more the question of, I think you're correct to say, the main thing here is soap's capacity to turn something into an eino ben yomo, as if it hasn't been used for a day, which, of course, letting something sit unused for a day does not mean you don't have to kosher it. It just means that if food comes in contact with it, it'll be unaffected. And absolutely nothing of what we've seen here is intended to waive the requirement of koshering. Okay? The reason that's still significant, though, is at least the brief foray we made on week 3 into Lechatchila and Bidiavad, and there being some scenarios that are Bidiavad after the fact scenarios before the fact, means that there may be scenarios where that's quite significant in terms of playing it out.
The Ramo, wouldn't it? I mean, the Ramo would say at Hosheri that you couldn't, you know, do this.
All right, we'll come back to it. We'll come back to it. Okay, I want to take, yeah, one more, and then I won't want to run too much over. Yeah.
Can you say a little bit about how this plays out in terms of the vessels used to wash things, such as dishwashers and sinks? I mean,
some people think that you need to have trays or basins in your sink.
Correct.
To keep the sink, I guess, from imparting to your dishes.
Correct.
Other people think that.
So correct. So the same principles pretty much would play out. If you adhere to ruling four, you would never even think about asking that question. You would never think of having two separate sinks. You would never think of having two dishwashers. You would never think of having a dishwasher only for one thing. Beyond that, with four, you would obviously wash in the same sink and in the same dishwasher, meat, milk, treif, kosher, etc., as long as soap was being used as an ingredient, you know, at some point in the process, basically. And you were never actively cooking it and then, you know, trying to get around koshering. But as long as it was, you know, sort of soap was present at some point, no issue. Three, even if you held just three, and on some level even, let's just talk about the kosher home, if you hold either three or two, you would basically never worry about any scenario where you felt very confident that soap had been in there from the beginning before anything else was mixing up. Right? So that is to say, this is where you often get to. People who are unwilling to rely on four, but are more comfortable with two and three, will say, well, as long as you have a dishwasher where either it doesn't have a time release such that the soap is held back before the hot water is, until the hot water is fully in, or you make sure to put soap in like that extra container outside the time release one, such that there's soap in there from the very beginning, then yes, your dishwasher is always parv. Because it never, ever absorbed anything without the presence of soap. Right? Only if you're kind of squarely in category one, and if you're sort of in categories two and three, but like only kind of to rely on them after the fact, will you say, well, I'll use the logic of two, three, and four not to make someone throw out their pot when there was a mistake, but I'll still say to them, don't set it up this way. That's effectively with the Ateret Paz here, which I gave you a brief snippet of. It's a long tshuva about whether you can wash meat and dairy dishes in the same dishwasher at the same time. And he basically says, yes, you can, but it's better to be a little stricter. Meaning the Ateret Paz basically thinks that position four is the correct position. But he says, but it's better to be strict, and therefore you should, you know, don't wash them at the same time. But he says 100% without any question, of course, you can do a fleishik load in the dishwasher and then wait 24 hours and then do a milchik load in the same dishwasher. Because at that point, you're sort of, you know, it's like epicycles on epicycles. It's like you're so far away from the concern in the world in which he lives where this is so compelling that he won't say that. Now, the Shach and the Taz would look at him like he was crazy. Right? Because they would say, what are you talking about? Like, the stuff is there. I don't care if the soap is here. That's a milchig dishwasher. It's been absorbing milk stuff. Right? So what? It's also been absorbing cascade. That's beside the point. Right? And if you think that way, it comes out very differently. All right? But the building blocks of what it looks like to make that argument is pretty clear from this. Right? All right, let me quickly take you through this last piece. We're not going to do all these sources, but I think you'll get this pretty quickly. The sources I have on the bottom of five are basically the sources about glass. And it's a classic medieval debate as to what the status of glass is. More or less, a good chunk of Ashkenazic opinion in the early years, and pretty much all of non-Ashkenazic opinion, think that glass is non-porous, and therefore never has a history, never has to be kosher, just has to be rinsed off, including for Pesach, including for treif, etc., etc. Okay? That's sort of what all those folks think, and then the sort of increasingly over time dominant Ashkenazi position is, no, glass is a problem. Glass is like a kli cheres, it's like earthenware, can't be koshered. And then this kind of intermediate position evolves in Ashkenaz, which says, well, if it's a glass thing that's basically like what you drink out of and don't really cook with, then you can soak it for 72 hours in water, change it two times in the middle, and by doing that, it'll, you know, sort of enough reverse its status to make it okay. All right, but what's important about that is just to see, there is a notion that there is such a thing as a non-porous material. Okay? How you interpret the Ashkenazi resistance to that, I think, is an interesting question. On the surface level, it seems like the Ashkenazim are saying, well, no, maybe it's not as non-porous as you think, etc. I think another equally plausible read of the Ashkenazi response to glass is being uncomfortable with there being a non-porous material. Right? That is to say, the idea that there's something that you just rinse, there's supposed to be a purging ritual. Again, in a way, this is another potential derivative of the Gemara's merging and conflating of the purging ritual with ta'am. The people who take ta'am really seriously as what purging is all about say, well, yeah, if that's what it's about, and this doesn't ever absorb flavor, then you never need to kosher it. Right? And that's on some level what the Sfaradi position is. What becomes a dominant Ashkenazi view uses this language of earthenware, etc. But in a way, you get a feeling that it's sort of saying, no, 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 you're supposed to have to kosher things once you use them for one thing. You can't just rinse it off, right, with a scouring pad. That's not enough. It doesn't provide sort of enough psychological transition from one state to another. Interpret that as you may. That lays the groundwork, I think, for how the materials revolution might or might not play in by this. And what do I mean by the materials revolution? I mean the idea of things like stainless steel, right, and other things that are entirely designed and entirely about in no way absorbing things, transferring flavor, etc., in a way that is, in theory, the modern instantiation of this. So, just playing that out simply with glass and the question of porous, non-porous is one way, but I want you just to see two final sources here that I think also represent this debate. On page 6, the Shulchan Aruch above, you can see the simple Sfaradi Ashkenazi divide between Rav Yosef Karo and the Rama. The Rashba says, we've already explained above that one may not intentionally nullify forbidden food. However, if a little bit of forbidden food gets absorbed into a vessel, then it is permitted to use that vessel if it is normally used with large quantities of food. The quantity of the prohibition is so small that it could never possibly contribute flavor to the permitted food. You have a pot that was used, someone put like a tiny bit of lard into that pot, okay, and began to cook with it, and then it was taken out. But it's like a big soup pot, it's not a frying pan, okay? And what you never cook a little amount in that soup pot, you always use a lot in it, and you will always have 60 times the amount of the small amount of isur that was used here. The Rashba says, therefore, you can use the pot without koshering it. Okay, it's very clearly. This is true even if the pot had been used in the past 24 hours, because there is absolutely no way that forbidden flavor could be transferred. If, however, the small amount of permitted food were absorbed in a utensil that is sometimes used with small amounts of food, like a shallow bowl and other similar items, then it's forbidden to use it even with large quantities, lest one use it with small quantities and end up in a situation where forbidden flavor has been transferred to the food. The Rashba creates this interesting category, very kind of unusual fact pattern, but nonetheless saying there's actually times where a pot has a treif history, but you are nonetheless allowed to use it without koshering it, because the only issue is ta'am. And if the proportions here are such that you will never get flavor contributed to your food, why shouldn't you use that pot? The Tur's response is, that seems unreasonable to permit, because if even a pot that hasn't been used in the last 24 hours, which can't possibly forbid the food in it, is forbidden, lest you use a more recently used pot, then certainly, when I'm talking about the same pot, which I might use for a large amount or a small amount of food, I shouldn't permit what the Rashba allows here, because what if, even if normally you use it for a lot of permitted food, you use it for a small amount, and you end up forbidding it, okay? Again, I would suggest to you that I think the Tur in some ways is resistant here to the idea that you can ever use a pot with a problematic history without koshering it. And you see again this tension between what drives this. Is it really about the flavor, or is it about having some kind of transitional ritual? Now, one of the ways you could imagine sort of thinking about this, kind of thinking this forward in terms of its application for today, is there are other ways in which this plays out, particularly in the materials revolution age, which is to say, forget about a pan or a pot that only used a small amount of isur. Imagine a material like Pyrex, like stainless steel, like all sorts of things, where even if you're not willing to say they're non-porous, you have nervousness about saying they're non-porous. Stainless steel, it's still metal. We have a tradition of treating metal as something that has pores, etc., etc. But what if their coefficient of absorption is so low that the maximum amount that they could ever possibly absorb would always be overwhelmed at least 60 to 1 by anything you would cook in it? That is to say, use the Rashba's same principle, but instead of amount of food that you use, amount of food that could possibly be absorbed because of the nature of the material. Right? You might even actually plausibly argue that the tour in that case might even permit, because it's a situation where that pot, no matter how much you cook in it, could never possibly contribute flavor to the food. And again, that would be the language that someone who thinks about this topic much more in terms of tam would come to ground, you know, a kind of much more lenient approach to modern materials and their use in the kitchen. Again, someone who's going to feel like you've got to kosher something that you know has some prior use is going to be much more uncomfortable with that, just like Ashkenazim have been around glass. Okay, so that's the other piece. I know we did that shorter, but I think it's actually a simpler kind of unit. Again, the soap on the one angle of the ta'am, but then what are these actual materials that we're using and how they add up into the larger picture? All right, so we'll take your comment, and then I want to move into sort of the question and synthetic phase here of trying to put this all together. Yeah.
It seems like there's a dialectic between both of these issues, because as materials have gotten less porous, more clearly neutral, soap is less intuitive at making any kind of difference, because it's part of the natural process of the dish, that the result is... It might just be because we clean things so often now, but the result is that we have these dishes that don't intuitively seem like they've absorbed anything, and thus soap is reactive as like an additional measure. It doesn't really have any kind of, again, experiential effect, because the dish is already so plain, so faultless.
With respect to the dish, right? Soap, I don't know that affects...
It's caked with food. It's
these other things, right? But that's an interesting question, how those two interact. Yeah, okay, I have to think about that. They definitely both conspire, I think, at the end of the day, for us to live in a world in which, you know, even sort of the phrase of the Gemara and other sources we'll talk about, you know, giulei goyim, the things that Gentile pots sort of spit out, right? And we think of that as sort of just a kind of a phrase, a way of talking about it, but I actually think we miss something of, there's like a reality there. There's a sense of, you look at someone's pot, it kind of has the residue of what they've been doing with it. And that is not our experience, right? Like the notion that, I mean, you could walk into, you know, many modern kitchens that are cooking treif morning till night. And after that pot has gone through the dishwasher and you look at it, you wouldn't necessarily detect anything about the history of that thing. And that has a deep psychological effect, I think, on how we relate to these objects. Great. Okay. I want to kind of open it up. There were a few things that I did get a couple emails from people, but I want to just take sort of a round of things that in our final 20 minutes or so people would like us to maybe try to pull together, and I don't promise to be able to get to all of them. But let's take a couple questions or thoughts, synthetic pieces of pulling some of this together. And I invite, you know, a focus also on the practical and not just the theoretical.
So at a practical level, you're in a treif restaurant, but you want to have a cup of coffee. Now that cup has probably been used before, you know, for let's say some ultra treif soup. Hypothetical.
Mm-hmm.
Now you want to have your cup of coffee. That cup, though, has been cleansed with soap. So based upon what we learned this evening, one might posit that you could have that cup of coffee. Not that that cup itself is okay, but the cup of coffee that you're having is fine because it's been cleansed through soap.
Okay, great. Well, I'm going to take like a bunch together. Great. So that's one question, one angle.
Sorry, can we talk about coffee already? Can you say if you're like in a non-Jewish town, you stop for coffee, it's okay?
Correct.
I might have missed that
class. That's okay. So yeah, I was going to come back. But yes, Anoda Biyahuda definitely addressed that case, and there were some parameters, but we'll talk about it. We'll just sort of revisit. Great. I mean, good memory.
Does that go back to the Vidyavad? Because, I mean, you know what's happened to this cup. It's not like you can close your eyes and say, this cup, you went in there knowing that this is the process that has happened. And I guess my question is that an issue?
Great. Parameters of Vidyavad to make that plausible. Yeah.
If it's ultimately about ta'am, can you eat in a restaurant that is completely vegan?
Right. Great. Okay.
So on this to this.
Okay. Yeah.
Mixed materials, very common in current pots. A glass-lidded pot with a stainless steel rim. How the heck do you kosher like that?
Okay. All right, yeah, maybe one more. Yeah.
יש משמעות לסיטואציה שבה אתה נמצא. אני מדברת למשל על הרבה ישראלים שנוסעים לחוץ לארץ לשבוע, ואומרים, בשבוע הזה אני מקפיד פחות, בין אם זה כי זה לא הסביבה הטבעית שלי, או כי זה לא אורח החיים הרגיל שלי, איפה זה נכנס.
Okay, how does situation play into it? I would say that falls into the parameters of Bidiyavad, and what one of my friends, actually the same guy of the Tide story, used to talk about as the vacation standard. Okay, great. Let's start with this. I'll pull in other issues that came up that some people flagged in communication was also thinking through, and I don't know how much we're going to be able to actually retool this, and I may have to talk with some of you offline after, but the question of Gentile food, Bishulei Goyim, and kind of going over the basic kind of parameters and thought values behind that. And then someone else actually wrote in about the question of the role of gender actually in all of this, both in terms of some of the chatnut, kind of social mixing questions, but also in terms of food preparation and what was Chazal's overall and, you know, a lot of these authorities that we've seen, what was actually their role in food preparation, how much are they involved, in some ways more of a historical question. Okay, well, let's take some of these through. And I want to say right off the bat here, like, I'm not up here in this forum to pronounce with, like, here's your sock and your heter and your isur of what you can and can't do. I'm happy to have those questions individually with people, those conversations, honestly. But I think that what's appropriate in this forum is to kind of pull together some of the things that we've learned for here's what it would look like to construct an argument for and against X and so forth. Okay? So, well, let's just review, go back to the parameters of the Vidyavad, because in a way that's very important for then applying this to any number of other pieces. So, yes, that's very important. The situation that you are in is very important. We saw that Noda B'Yehuda that talked about there being a difference between what you might do when you are in a town where basically there is a Jewish coffee shop or you have your own things available, as opposed to when you're on the road and you're dependent on someone else. We saw sources of the Tosafot talking about that public oven and the one kind of pizza board that you're, you know, putting things in on the oven on, and when you don't have access to your own one that follows your perfect specs, that being a bidiyavad situation. Again, the same physical reality, but the different context being different. There's a much richer literature around that. Other issues that sort of push you into the bidiyavad zone are really, I would say, you know, in the best language, I think, to my mind around this is situations out of your control. Things can be out of your control for any number of reasons. One way is to be away from home and not to have access to things. Sometimes they are somewhat emotionally out of your control. That is to say, someone who is in their parents' house and their parents do not run their house in terms of kashrut, the way they run their house at home, and they do not have the capacity either physically or relationally to blowtorch the entire kitchen. That's a bidiyavad situation. That is certainly a fair argument to describe that as a bidiyavad situation, which would mean whenever I am dealing with a fact pattern where the food after the fact wouldn't be forbidden if it went through some process, I can actively go ahead and prepare, rely on it, etc. So that notion, again, there's sort of a spectrum there, and you'll have some arguments, right? People are going to have different, slightly different lines, both individuals but post-scheme as well, as to what really counts as being that kind of bidiyavad situation. But the basic language of saying, let me say it this way, I think it's very important for everybody with a commitment to kashrut to have those two categories. You should walk around in life with an understanding of the lechatchila and the bidiyavad situations, and understanding that there are two slightly different set of rules that apply to those two different situations. Then, based on the individual person, the individual story, that may not look exactly the same for every person, but that halacha category is a very important category, and it plays a critical role in distinguishing between things that are substantively problematic from things that are procedurally problematic. Things that are substantively problematic is that whole list we started this series off with. The things you're not supposed to eat. The things that the Torah says, don't eat these. The things that are procedurally problematic are things like, I'm supposed to kosher this pot. But if I didn't, it doesn't matter. Right? So, doesn't matter, I don't mean, you understand what I mean, it doesn't affect the food. So that is the difference between, you know, on one clear end of the spectrum is what you do in your own house where you have control. That's lechatchila, okay? On the other clear end of the spectrum is the food is already done and now sitting in front of you and there's no other food, that's an alternative. I don't mean you're going to starve, but meaning there's not some, you know, kosher bakery alternative, etc. Those two categories have to exist, and where exactly it plays out in the middle, that's part of what we saw, some of the conversation, but there's more to say. Once you kind of figure out where you are there, that is going to, in a large part, drive the kind of sensible answers to questions about things like cups of coffee and, more broadly, eating in the vegan restaurant. All right, let's go to the bigger question. We can subsume the cup of coffee. Let's talk about the vegan restaurant, okay? To quickly just sort of go through what we've seen, right? From session one, right? Yeah, you can't eat anything that is forbidden by the Torah or by Chazal, right? So the number one assumption is, yes, you're not eating any of those things, right? As we then saw, there's then the question of trust. How much can I rely on whom to provide me that information in a responsible way? And we saw the principle of uman lo mera nafshei, person having a professional reputation to uphold. I told that little story of the vegetarian restaurant in England where I went in and asked if their wines were vegetarian, and they were shocked that I even asked such a question. Of course they were, right? And having a feeling of that was clearly a professional culture of ne'emanut. In other places, including south of the Mason-Dixon line, that is not always the case, okay? No offense to anyone from that part of the country, lovely people, right? But not the same culture of assumption of, you know, of what's in a vegetarianism and those issues, okay? So that's sort of, I think, then the next question, right? It's like, can I trust this establishment, and are their standards in sync with mine? Right, so if it's obviously, I assume you're saying vegan in order to take the cheese piece out of it. Obviously, you know, depending on what you're doing with cheese, which is sort of beyond cheese and wine, we didn't get. We should do like a wine and cheese series, right? And at the end, we can have wine and cheese. But right, obviously that's just any. It can apply to anything. It could be a vegetarian restaurant where the cheese is syncing up with your standards of. You assume that cheese isn't violating anything in that list of the Torah and Chazal. So, you want to make sure there's nothing there, and you want to make sure that it's trustworthy. And that's some combination of, I think, the individual store, proprietor, business, and some kind of broader culture that reinforces that. Right? Then there's the question of the pots, the history of the pots, etc. So in your average vegan restaurant, once you've gotten to the level of trust that there's nothing in there that is problematic. Well, I'd say there's two things, right? There's one is the question of, is there nothing in your food that you are eating that's problematic? Okay, but that could in theory be true at a restaurant that serves all sorts of things. There's then the second level of, what can you assume and are you entitled to assume about the history of those pots, right? So in a context where you actually feel that there's no problematic ingredient in that restaurant whatsoever, to a level of confidence that you just trust. And remember, what I was pushing in that unit was, that's not magic, that's just about, you know, you're taking a risk, and do you trust the information? Would you rely on it? And if you're confident that like that's the way this has always operated and these pots don't come from the restaurant next door that closed down last month, then in theory the pots have no issue around them. Right? There's nothing to talk about. To the extent that the pots, you're not at all confident, maybe you even have some degree of confidence that they have been used in a problematic context, right? Then you really start to get into whether you are in a bidiyavad or a lechatchila situation. Right? Because then what you're saying is, well, the pots may have had some problematic use in the past, but I feel very confident that what was just prepared in them is not a problem. And now the question is, am I going to remember the whole conversation about stam kelim einan b'nei oman? Can I presume that I got a 24-hour distance from the pots, or do I have to suspect? Do I have to engage that question? But then what you'll really move into, the main question will be lechatchila b'diavad. If it's a lechatchila situation, and it's the kind of pot that if it were in your own house, you would kosher, then it's problematic. If it's a bidiyavad situation, then it doesn't really matter. So how do you think that through? Well, again, there's a range. I would say, you know, being out on the road and there being nowhere else to go, you know, the Noda B'Yehuda has language for that being a bidiyavad situation, pretty strong. Being invited to such a restaurant for some kind of family event where it will cause some major ripples not to be there, it seems also pretty safely to me in the category of bidiyavad. When you start getting into, I'm now choosing between, let's say, 17 kosher restaurants in the same city as there are, you know, 15 vegan ones, and it's really just more the thing of, is this totally neutral? There I think you would have to get to a point of, well, with a vegan restaurant, if you're totally confident about the history, you may be fine on that axis. More generally, you may have to get to the point of saying that, no, like, my being out of the house, actually, and it not being, you know, my stuff, is itself a bidiyavad situation. That's pushing it, right? That's pushing to that end of the spectrum to suggest that. And that's the vacation standard piece, right? It's a lot more compelling on some level to say, when I don't have a lot of options, okay, then, fine, I'll call that a bidiyavad situation. But when I do, it's somewhere in there. So again, that's the kind of thing, I'm happy to talk about that like specifically on sort of individual bases, but that would be what you'd be thinking through on that. Now again, just proceeding through, the other issues of bishulei goyim, and in those questions of context, to permit in a vegan restaurant context, you would basically have to be relying on the Ra'a's opinion that cooking in that kind of neutral space is not significant in terms of those questions and those issues. And therefore it just goes away and it doesn't apply in that setting at all. As we saw, right, every one of those factors that we just went through is contentious and is argued over. So I guess the simplest way to answer that question, and I think that the coffee cup is just it's even easier to get to that, right? A lot easier to get to that.
The soap in your pot.
And then there's the soap and all of this, right? I mean, that's
vegan not worried because they washed it with soap.
That's correct. No, that's correct. Let's say it this way. I think it's pretty clear from everything we've seen why someone would not eat in a vegan restaurant and how you would construct a totally plausible halakhic argument that you could. Right? But it hinges on all those factors that we've gone through. It's the factors of verifying what's in front of you, who are you trusting, what is the situation, the actual history of the pots, and then your own relationship of what situation am I in? Is it a temporary situation? Am I under pressure, etc.? And then the question of, you know, neutral and otherwise colored spaces. And then add on top of it the question of whether the history of the pots even matters in the same way as it did because of soap and the materials revolution, and you're quite a distance along the way there. That, I think, you've seen a number of tshuvot. I just want to sort of emphasize that. You've seen a number of tshuvot along the way that have done this. That will not say, now that we have soap, you can eat anywhere you want, right? But they will say things like, well, given that there's soap, and the coefficient of absorptions of these things are very low, and I'm in a kind of bidiyavad situation, and I pretty much trust that these people are telling me the truth, with all those factors combined, then I feel comfortable being in this situation. And that, I think, is actually overall a healthy way to approach these questions, not to try to kind of pick one factor that comes out on one side and to say, yeah, that's what I'm going with. Like, I'm going with the ra'ah, neutral space, erases all concerns, etc. I don't have to think about it at all. But instead, to actually think about all the different components kind of working together to produce a nuanced answer. We can talk about that more. The koshering materials, let's talk offline, because it's basically, I mean, each thing is sort of totally crazy. But, you know, the short answer is there's really no cracks, and both of the materials are things that on their own you would kosher. There's no particular reason not to kosher it. The problem with most things like that is they have, like, cracks and crevices that make it impossible to really have it sort of start over. And the one thing I guess I'll say about that is, if you think about, in light of what we've seen, the purging rituals as being about imagining starting over, things that have cracks, that things get lodged in, make it hard for you to forget its prior use, right? Instead of just thinking of it as sort of a magical thing, like a Teflon pan with a whole bunch of scratches on it is marked up from what happened to it before in a way that something that isn't, you know, just isn't in that way. So, but that's more or less the principle that would play out. Well, I guess I'll just close with a piece on this and then talk about it more afterwards with anyone who wants. I want to acknowledge sort of the difficulty of the questions of context and Gentile-Jewish relationships, and some of those texts even to some sounding very kind of offensive and deeply problematic. I want to just sort of give two further pitches for thinking about that. One is to remind you that internal to that topic, it is very much not a topic that functions in a sort of tum'at tahara, corruption by contact kind of way. As we saw, part of what was very interesting about that topic was the same exact physical action with different considerations of either what the food was or the context in which it was being eaten, etc., completely changed the entire application of the psak. And in that sense, what I think it's inviting us to do, which is the reason I wanted to have this series bichlal, is to think much more thoughtfully about the ways in which food actually, you know, not just shapes our personal practice, but also creates community in all kinds of different ways. And of course, that becomes a conversation. You know, any of these other topics that are ostensibly just about cups, that's often another factor that comes into this, which is to say, well, maybe I think such and such is okay, but what kind of circles do I run in that do or don't permit or pressure or encourage X kind of behavior? And it's sort of to be expected that food has some dimension around that, because it is such a social activity, which is both the reason that food creates certain categories that are about nervousness of the other, but also the reason that I think so many of us are driven to find ways often to eat more things in more places, because it does sort of open up certain social doors and points of contact that are exactly the flip side of why it's such a powerful force, potentially for good or for bad, depending on your perspective. So there's a lot more to say on this. I, again, offer myself as a conversation partner offline. I will just say, by way of closing, since this is our kind of concluding public program for the Zman, just to really, you know, thank all of you for being here as a presence in making this the Makom Torah that both we, and I say we, both the faculty, but also really the fellows here full-time at the yeshiva that have worked so hard to anchor it in that way, have really made it. It's been a pleasure to learn with you and to discuss all of this. I hope you will take the material that we have we've chewed on here, as it were, and you know, really, really play it out in a more thoughtful and proactive way in your lives on a very kind of daily and real basis. And I would encourage you also, if you did love and benefit from this conversation and this learning of Torah, to do two things. One is to come back and to learn with us again in various different contexts, and also to think about making a contribution that really supports the work that we're doing here. Obviously, we have there's a nominal entrance fee for coming to this series, but to really make this possible, not just for the people in this room, but on the web and in all the ways that we try to make this Torah touch people, it really requires that broad base of support. So I thank you all for being here and look forward to learning with you again. Shakar.